Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We rely on MLK Day as our day to really get set for the garden season. This would take weeks if we did it with just a couple garden volunteers.
Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and several other food organizations were packed with volunteers on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Throughout the show, we'll visit a few service projects and hear how the food community spent the day on, not the day off. Harvest Public Media introduces us to the two ranchers who became activists as they worked to change the federal beef checkoff program. Some recipes for burned supper with Chef Daniel Orr, one you could make tonight for dinner, no problem, and another one that might turn some stomachs. And are neonic pesticides not as effective in protecting crops as we thought? The EPA is looking into it. What stories did our reporters look at this week? Luann Johnson has an overview.
How much is that funnel cake or that KFC Double Down really worth to you? When the FDA rolled out new calorie count label rules late last year, the agency took a stab at estimating the value that a consumer loses when they choose healthy, lower-calorie foods over energy-packed foods like sausage-stuffed takeout pizza. The estimated deficit adds up to more than $5 billion. Here's how it's supposed to work. When a consumer pays for something, they get some kind of benefit. The buyer might even want the product enough to pay a higher price for it. The difference between the actual price and what they would be willing to pay is called a consumer surplus. Buried somewhere in that difference are lots of subjective factors like convenience, trendiness, taste, texture, and the overall pleasure that the product delivers. It's guesswork, but the estimated dollar amounts from this subjective surplus stems from real economic data. When the FDA wanted to weigh costs and benefits of the calorie label rule, it used a new model that compares health benefits from labeling to lost consumer surplus from choosing healthier foods. To arrive at its $5 billion figure, the FDA used a simplified version of a model developed by economist Jason Abeluk of the Yale University School of Management. Abeluk agrees with the FDA's use of lost value factors. He said it's not realistic to focus just on public health benefits when drafting policies. There's so much more to this story. Chad Bouchard's article explaining this idea of the pleasure factor is at eartheats.org. 80% of Americans support, quote, mandatory labels on foods containing DNA, unquote. But hang on, all foods contain DNA. The curious survey was conducted by Oklahoma State. The results don't tell as much about consumers' food opinions and knowledge as they do about the lack thereof. The question about DNA was at the end of a long list of government and policy issues. Poll takers could choose support or oppose. Most of the issues were fairly recognizable, like a tax on sugared sodas. Another question was mandatory labels on foods produced with genetic engineering. It's likely those taking the poll glossed over the DNA question, wanting to support labeling rather than considering what DNA actually is. And on any given day, 20% of American children are eating pizza. All of that pizza adds up. It's the second leading source of calories for children, right behind sugary grain-based desserts like cookies. The study, released in the journal Pediatrics, used data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. It tracked 11,000 children aged 2 to 11 and adolescents 12 to 19. On the days they ate pizza, children and adolescents used a quarter of their calories on the food. Some dietitians look at this as an opportunity to introduce more vegetables to young people. When parents serve pizza, add vegetables as toppings.
Or you know what? You can always make your own pizza at home. We have a few recipes, in fact, that lay out how to make your own crust and suggestions for toppings, gluten-free, vegan, a bunch of recipes at eartheats.org. Luann Johnson, what's your favorite pizza topping?
Pineapple with gorgonzola.
Ooh, nice. Till next week, thanks.
Till next time, Annie Corrigan. Till next time.
It seemed like a good idea for the beef business. cattlemen wanted to raise money to promote their product, so a law was passed and everyone chipped in. Billions of dollars later, a couple of Kansas cowboys are raising questions and commotion about the program. As Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports, their cries are as old as the Boston Tea Party: taxation without representation.
David Frank is not your old school cowboy. He drives across this pasture in north central Kansas on a cold and windy spring day, not on a horse, but in a Ford F-350 pickup.
Now, 3 hours ago, this thing was born.
Frank spots a newborn calf standing on shaky legs near its mother at the edge of the pasture. He's wary of the mama cow.
Have you ever seen that movie, Forrest Gump? This is like a box of chocolate here. You don't know what you're going to get. You know, they're very protective.
Frank grabs a shepherd's stick and slowly moves towards the animals. He catches a baby by a hind leg and brings her down. In an instant, Frank clips the calf's ear with a bright yellow plastic tag, number 7034, an ID that helps track it from birth to sale. She is now the next animal in line to fund what's called the Beef Checkoff Program.
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Those commercials featuring cowboy movie star Sam Elliott are some of the most recognized ad campaigns ever. They're created by the Cattlemen's Beef Board, and they're funded by guys like Frank. By federal law, cattle producers have to contribute $1 to the checkoff for each animal they sell. Half the money goes to state beef groups, the other half to the national board. The checkoff has become a $2 billion bonanza that helped the industry promote beef and buy research.
I call it a liberty tax.
Why do you call it that?
We just lost some liberty.
By law, the cattlemen must pay even if they don't have a say in how the money is spent or even get to see the books. They must pay even if they believe the checkoff advances the interests of big corporations over their own. And their fears were realized when a U.S. Inspector General's report showed that the government was providing no oversight of the checkoff funds.
Not a volunteer. It's mandatory. We just lost some freedom. And we're not being represented. We can't get on the board. Can't do this and this. We lost some liberty right now.
Frank and a neighboring cattleman, Jim Dobbins, have become ranching revolutionaries. They've investigated the local group that collects the checkoff. That's called the Kansas Livestock Association. They were shocked to learn that it takes in double-digit millions every year and that its executives make six-figure salaries. When they're not raising cattle, Dobbins and Frank raise corn. They told me they cooked up this commotion while riding on their tractors.
See, you go back and forth and back and forth. Well, that doesn't take a real mental giant, fortunately.
I guess, yeah.
To do that. Yeah. So we have time to think.
And turned us into activists. This is wrong.
Other producers across the country are angry that just one organization gets most of the checkoff money. The National Beef Cattlemen's Association is based in suburban Denver and rakes in over $40 million a year from the checkoff. Both the national and local beef groups refuse to talk to us on tape, but they maintain most farmers and ranchers appreciate the program.
My name is Tim Manson. I'm a tractor tire salesman slash farmer. I live in Tonganoxie, Kansas.
Manson doesn't mind paying the dollar because it also goes to pay for educating consumers and fighting problems like E. coli or mad cow disease.
It actually is marketing for all of us. That dollar a head's pretty cheap.
Now many in the industry want to double that dollar, making farmers and ranchers pay $2 a head when they sell an animal. They need the money, they say, because the drought has brought on losses and chicken has overtaken beef as America's favorite meat. The industry has been fighting about it for 3 years, and Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack is frustrated.
Because they're locking horns, tens of millions of dollars of promotion and research and marketing isn't getting done at a time when there's domestic competition and international opportunity. I mean, seriously, does that make sense?
Back at David Frank's place in central Kansas, number 7034 has been taken off pasture and is being fattened with corn. She's good-natured, so Frank figures he'll keep her for a while. If she's around for 13 years, the average lifespan of a heifer, with one calf a year, Frank says she'll contribute at least $13 to the checkoff. But he's fighting that. He hopes that when he does sell those animals, he won't have to fatten up the coffers of a group that won't tell him where his money is going. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
In the second half today, will farmers stop using a certain class of pesticides if the government can prove they're ineffective? Another story from Harvest Public Media. This past Monday was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Instead of going to work or school, many people chose to volunteer their time to work community service projects. Earth Eats visited several food-related organizations to see how the extra people power was being utilized. We start at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, a food pantry in Bloomington, Indiana. Brandon Sherm is the hub's volunteer coordinator, and he's directing traffic today. He's also monitoring the deep cleaning that's happening in the front of the building.
We have so many people coming through at 12 to 6 during the week. We don't have time to do that as often as possible. So we have people cleaning the pantry and cleaning our deep freezer and our coolers.
About 40 volunteers got to work at 10 a.m. It's very fast-paced and a little stressful around here this morning.
Because our pantry opens in about an hour and a half or so. So not only do they have to clean all this, but then we need to make sure it's ready to go at 12 o'clock for folks to shop.
About 300 people come through the pantry every day as customers. Working my way back to the demonstration kitchen, another dozen volunteers are pulling burners off the stove, washing cabinets, sweeping the floors. When was the last time that stove was cleaned?
Oh, it's cleaned once a day, every day.
It's getting some TLC today, that's for sure. Stephanie Solomon is the Director of Education and Outreach. She's overseeing a large group of folks sterilizing and cleaning garden trays and plastic pots.
We rely on MLK Day as our day to really get set for the garden season, and so we always rely on a nice big group getting together. This would take weeks if we did it with just a couple garden volunteers.
Kate Zilvinskis is one of the people packed into this room. She's at the end of the process, standing up, drying the containers, and then stacking them.
There's sort of an assembly line style happening. So we've got, 15 plus people in here. We've got four or so who are dry scraping out a lot of containers and then giving those containers to folks who are seated on the floor with large basins to wash these containers.
That smell in this room, it's the vinegar bath. Getting out of here, the final service project at the hub today is in their conference room, which, again, it's just packed with a dozen kids and their parents mostly. It's pretty calm in here, all things considered. The constant sound is the click, click of seeds being poured into plastic bags. Kendra Brewer runs the garden program.
Because in the pantry, we like to focus on showing people how to grow things in the winter. And microgreen flats are a nice, easy thing to do to get fresh greens all year long.
There are four different seeds they're working with. All could be grown indoors for microgreens. 5-year-old Thomas Koldvard is here with his father.
Sardine seeds. Radish seed.
What do you think about radishes? Have you had a radish?
Yes.
And he likes them.
Plain and after they've been washed.
They toss the little plastic bags into gigantic cardboard boxes. There are probably hundreds of finished packets in there. What would you be doing today if you weren't here?
Probably playing with Legos.
Graham is 7 years old, sitting next to his mother, Ellen Mackay.
We're putting seeds into a big pot for people's gardens.
Kale seeds, to be specific.
I don't really know what kale is.
It's a dark green. We had kale. We talked about it, remember? It's sort of like spinach.
I'm not a big fan of roasted leaves.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Roasted leaves. He doesn't like roasted leaves. You could try a raw kale salad, Graham. Thanks to all the hard workers at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Coming up, we'll go to the Hoosier Hills Food Bank. Chef Daniel Orr has his ingredients in front of him. Guess the recipe. All right, here's a hint. It's a traditional Scottish dish.
All right, so we have the lamb's heart, the lamb kidneys, lungs, and liver of some sort. You could use chicken liver, pork liver, beef liver.
Did you guess haggis? Yep, it's haggis. They're getting ready for their fifth annual burn supper at Farm Bloomington. No burn supper would be complete without haggis. To get ready for this dish, they've been collecting organ meats from the animals they buy for the restaurant. These particular hearts and lungs and kidneys came from Wee Farm out of southern Indiana. Daniel includes some unusual ingredients to make his haggis special.
And then we have this caul fat that we've mixed up with the roasted steel-cut oats and all the vegetables that we've boiled with all those entrails and then ground up and made into this wonderful pate-like mixture that we've seasoned with scotch and foie gras and lots of fresh herbs and mushrooms. Then what we're going to do is make little balls with the mixture and then wrap it up into the caul fat, which is one of the linings of the cow stomach.
It really looks like a cheesecloth.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like lace, edible lace. And the caul fat, as it roasts, is going to melt and kind of self-baste the haggis inside. Wonderful dish. And you know what? We're selling 70, 80 haggis a weekend during the Burns weekend.
Is it people coming in really loving haggis, or they're just buying it out of morbid curiosity?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. But once you get them hooked...
I'd try it, would you? Daniel says he serves the haggis with mashed rutabaga and potato, a recipe he made for us several years ago, in fact. Hear that coming up in the second half of the show. Then the EPA is questioning whether a certain class of pesticides actually improves yields.
Neonicotinoids are being re-examined, and they're moving up the date for releasing some of their analyses,
which could help bees. Christopher Husted brings us that story. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Hi there, I'm Annie Corrigan. We're continuing our trip around to food service projects for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, now at the Hoosier Hills Food Bank. They're expecting some 250 volunteers to come through the food bank today in several different shifts. Shift number one today is repackaging 40,000 pounds of apples Hoosier Hills recently bought. Volunteers Asia Harris, Susan Johnson, and Joy Forrest came over from the Indiana University campus.
Always Zeta Phi Beta.
The Upper Saline Kappa Zeta graduate chapter here in Bloomington.
Actually, today is our global day of service, so fits in well every year.
They reach into a waist-high cardboard bin filled with apples. They fill mesh bags with 8 apples each.
We're amazed at the size of these apples, the sheer and utter size. We're like, if we bought these at Kroger, this would be quite a bit of money.
Yes. They're pretty big.
They told us don't bruise the apples.
Yeah, what are the requirements? Don't bruise the apples, 8 to a bag. What else?
We have to twist tight. The twisting. Oh, the twisting.
Tie them tight. Don't drop them in the bag. You have to place them in there very, very delicately.
Why is the twisting hard?
I'm not a very good twister.
It's hard when you have 8 apples and they're filled to the top and you don't have enough bag to twist. So it's pretty challenging.
So, as you guys can see, we are moving through these apples pretty quickly. What we're going to have to do in order to have enough work for the other two shifts is we're going to have to stop at 11 instead of 11:30.
Asia, Susan, and Joy were just too efficient at their work. What will they be doing with the rest of their day today? Probably getting some friends together to go see the movie Selma. One more story from MLK Day just ahead. Researchers are worried about honeybees. Some are looking into a possible link between beehive collapse and a class of pesticides commonly used on Midwest farms. A recent report says the pesticides aren't even that effective. So will farmers stop using them? Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted takes a look.
Initially, the pesticide called neonicotinoids, or neonics, was developed back in the early 90s to fight wireworm and beanleaf beetles. Corn and soybean seeds are treated with the pesticide to keep these bugs away in the spring while the seed sprouts. But Iowa State University researcher Mary Harris says dust from the neonic treatment lands on blooming plants that bees take back to the hive.
At this time, they're trying to start up the first brood for the year. And if they're bringing back contaminated pollen, that's what they're feeding the first brood.
Farmers latched on to the pesticides, and now almost half of the soybean seeds in the U.S. are treated with neonicotinoids. Peter Nowak is a seed researcher. Funded by several seed companies, including Syngenta and Bayer, his team looked at more than 400 soybean plots and found about a 3% yield increase when neonics were applied to the seeds.
It is very significant to the producers that are taking advantage of that yield enhancement. And the safety, the convenience, the time and labor saving associated with it.
When it comes down to it, many growers use neonics as insurance. It helps them sleep at night thinking their crops are protected and that there's a less likely chance they'll have to replant, which costs a hefty sum. But now the Environmental Protection Agency is calling the pesticide's efficacy into question. After studying 64 test plots of soybeans, the agency did not see a significant difference in yields between those planted with the treated seeds and those without treatment. The treatment is expensive, and it could hurt bees. So does it work or not? At this point, farmers can't be sure. On a wet winter day in Salisbury, Missouri, Seth Ricketts fires up his seed treater.
Once we're ready to treat, what happens is, that door would be open, and we have a conveyor that would then carry it from the seed treater into, a farmer's seed tender.
Come spring, farmers will be lining up to pick up their seed orders from Ricketts, who runs Ricketts Farm Service. He says over the past decade, he's seen increased interest and sales of the neonic treatment.
I see it fluctuating a little bit with soybean prices. If we have really high soybean prices, that return on investment changes. It takes fewer bushels to pay back that investment, so it's easier to make.
About 70% of his seeds are treated with pesticide. And until he sees a change in demand, most of the seeds he sells will have the pesticide coating. New EPA report or not?
No, I wouldn't say that I have no concern, but I don't have a whole lot of concern.
Mary Harris at Iowa State says she thinks we will start seeing a change in neonic use by the 2016 season. The EPA has already announced its plan to restrict neonic use during certain times of the year, and it's fast-tracking its study on the pesticide's effect on pollinators with encouragement from the Obama administration.
Neonicotinoids are being reexamined, and they're moving up the date for releasing some of their analyses.
If federal research connects the pesticide to bee die-offs, Harris says farmers will have to return to scouting their fields more often for insects looking to score a free meal. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Connect with these reporters at harvestpublicmedia.org. We had the haggis with Daniel Orr a little bit ago. Now for a traditional side dish for our burn supper. He learned about this rutabaga and potato mash recipe from his Polish grandmother. And now he's making it a bit fancier for us today.
So these are the rutabagas. They're very, very easy to use. You're going to trim off the exterior, and the wax is there to keep them fresh. And what I've done is I've already got some cooked. I cooked them about halfway in water, then drained them off, and then added some chicken stock. And then over here, I've got some potatoes that cook the same way. Okay, I'm going to add a pinch of sugar and a little bit of lemon zest. Okay, Grandma didn't put the lemon zest in.
This is your touch.
But that's my touch. I'm going to add a little bit of butter. Okay, and a little bit of heavy cream. And the potatoes are going to give you that starchiness, and the root vegetable, the rutabaga, will give you a nice sweetness. And I'm not going to mash these up too much. I don't really want a puree. I want kind of a rustic mash. Okay, and that's basically all there is to it. I'm going to turn off the heat and give it a taste test. Pinch more sugar, pinch more salt, maybe just a little more butter. Okay, and that is our mashed rutabaga and potato side dish.
Recipes, photos, so many great ideas for dinner tonight at eartheats.org. We were just talking about the health of bees with Harvest Public Media. The Bloomington Community Orchard depends on pollinators to make their fruit grow. That's why they dedicated their Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day service project to building Mason Bee Homes. I stopped by the very boomy atrium at City Hall, where organizers were getting everything set up. Volunteers will be doing some serious building with wood panels and nails and hammers.
And I do go and, you know, talk to people and... Okay.
Diane Jung directs me to a quieter part of the room. She's with the Bloomington Environmental Council, and she's with Lawns for Life, which advocates for growing native plants instead of grass and not using pesticides at all. Obviously, pollinators are an important part of how she keeps her alternative lawn thriving. The sound over here is more subtle. Andrea Avena is slicing bamboo into foot-long shoots.
And sometimes they split. Most of the times they split, actually. Sometimes you're lucky and they don't.
Jung harvested a lot of this bamboo from her yard. It was starting to take over. So this, she thought, was a perfect way to put the invasive plant to good use. Ria Collet is preparing the bamboo as well. She also has a backyard habitat wildlife garden made up of mostly native plants.
But I've never made a mason bee house, and so I thought I would come and help and make one for myself as well.
And it's amazing how many of these bamboos it really takes to fill that little space.
Yeah, let's count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, oh my goodness, 40?
At least, yeah. So we have quite a bit of birthing opportunities here for the mason bees. So
it's like an apartment complex.
It is. A birthing site.
Will the bees just know to come, or are you guys going to insert bees?
It is sort of a, if you put it there, they will come. But you actually can buy mason bee starters, kind of like a sourdough starter kit in a way.
Few more bamboo segments and they should be ready for the volunteers to start building. You can see a picture of these mason bee houses on our Twitter account. We'll also post instructions for how to make your own. It's not hard at all. Find us on Twitter at Earth Eats. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33-RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Get out there. Have a great day today. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.